Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a journey, really, spanning centuries, crossing continents, to unravel the intricate, often quite violent history of one of the world's most famous jewels, the Koh-i-Noor Diamond. Imagine it right now, maybe you've seen it sparkling under glass in the jewel house at the Tower of London. It looks like this, well, inert object of just dazzling beauty. But behind that brilliance, locked within its facets, lie centuries of blood, betrayal, the rise and fall of empires, and the relentless march of colonial power. It's a truly captivating story that goes way beyond just geology. So the central question for our deep dive today is really this. How did this legendary diamond travel all the way from the ancient glittering courts of India, literally born from the earth of Golconda, to ultimately end up adorning the crowns of Britain? And maybe even more importantly, what does its tumultuous journey tell us about power, ownership, identity, and history itself, especially in our modern world? What does it truly represent today to all the different peoples whose hands it passed through?
That's precisely our mission for this deep dive. We're going to meticulously trace the full and often, tumultuous history of the Koh-i-Noor. We'll move from its origins in India through its imperial moments with, say, the Mughals and the Sikhs, and then its eventual appropriation by the British Empire. We'll explore how its symbolic power changed as it passed through different dynasties and empires. You know, how its shifts in ownership were a direct reflection of these really profound political power struggles and conquests. We'll definitely delve into its colonial appropriation. And of course, we have to confront the very modern controversies surrounding its repatriation. Plus, we can't forget the rich mythology and those enduring legends, including that notorious curse that has clung to it for centuries, often shaping its narrative in really fascinating ways.
Okay, so let's unpack this right from the very beginning. Let's trace the diamond's roots. To really understand the Koh-i-Noor, we have to go back to its likely origins in the, well, fabled Golconda mines of southern India. These mines, they're located near modern Hyderabad, were, for centuries, pretty much the only source of the world's finest diamonds. They produced gems that were, quite frankly, unlike anything seen before, the size, the clarity, the brilliance. And when it was first discovered, this diamond was just astonishing in its original uncut state. It was a massive 793 carats.
Wow, 793.
Yeah, I mean, to give you a sense of scale, that's almost four times its current size. It was genuinely one of the largest known diamonds in the entire world. Just this raw, immense stone. It must have commanded awe from the second it emerged from the earth.
And what's truly fascinating here is that its earliest recorded appearances might date as far back as the 13th century, possibly connected to the Kakati dynasty in India. This really grounds it in a deeply ancient historical context within the subcontinent, you know? It shows its long-standing significance even before it got its famous name.
Right, so it was already important way back then.
Exactly. Imagine a gem already legendary, already tied to power for hundreds of years before it really entered the wider world's consciousness. Its presence in the Kakatiya treasury, apparently guarding the city of Warangal, speaks volumes about its early role as a symbol of regional might and prosperity.
And this isn't just about, you know, a pretty rock. It's about a gem steeped in narrative drama and really profound mythology. This is where it gets super interesting. Ancient Indian mythology surrounding gems is incredibly rich and complex. We really need to talk about the tale of the Samantaka jewel from the Bhagavad Purana, because it truly sets the stage for the Koh-i-Noor's later reputation.
Yes, the Samantaka jewel. As it's described in the Bhagavad Purana, it was said to be the brilliant jewel of the sun god Surya. He apparently wore it around his neck, and it granted him his dazzling appearance. It was this irresistible object of wonder, coveted by everyone, but it also had this profound dual nature. It was believed that when worn by a clean man, it produces gold, but to an unclean person, it indubitably proves fatal.
Wow. So a moral compass in a gem.
Kind of, yeah. What this myth reveals is this foundational cultural understanding in India, that these aren't just inert objects of beauty or wealth. They're seen as living entities with profound moral agency, capable of bestowing blessings or curses based on the character of the person who holds them. This deeply embedded cultural context made the Koh-i-Noor and stones like it far more than just a stone. It became a vessel for destiny, a living symbol that commanded not just reverence, but also, you know, fear and obsession.
That's a critical lens, isn't it?
Absolutely. It distinguishes it from how, say, a European crown jewel might be perceived, where the focus is often purely on monetary value or just aesthetic beauty. This had agency.
And the drama doesn't stop there. The story around the Samantaka is just full of intrigue and violence. There's King Satrajit, who initially had the jewel but then falsely accused Krishna of stealing it. Then Prince Satatanva brutally murdered Satrajit and seized the gem, only for Krishna to exact swift vengeance, cutting off Satatanva's head with his razor-sharp throwing disc, the Sudarshan Chakra, Krishna's divine weapon.
Right. A classic tale of divine justice.
Exactly. This story powerfully highlights these themes of greed, violence, and the dangerous allure associated with such powerful jewels in Indian lore. It almost uncannily foreshadows the real-world history of the Kohinoor, where its passage from hand to hand is so often marked by bloodshed and treachery.
And if we connect this to the broader cultural picture, it's worth noting that the world's oldest treatises on gems and gemology, known as Ratna Shastras, were written in ancient India, long before any similar European texts.
Really? That early?
Oh, yes. This underscores the deep cultural significance and reverence for gems that existed there. In Indian courts, like those of the Chola dynasty or the Vijayanagara Empire, gems weren't just decoration. They symbolized beauty, affluence, and power. Kings even claimed ownership of any stone weighing over 30 carats, highlighting this inherent royal connection to these precious objects. The symbolic weight of gems was just immense, not merely for their material value, but for what they embodied about the king's divine right and prosperity.
Pieces of heaven on earth, as you said.
Precisely. They were meant to awe and command reverence.
So, despite this incredibly long and storied history, the diamond's earliest journey through the, you know, shifting landscape of ancient and medieval India is still somewhat shrouded in mystery. Its specific path through various hands, from the Kakatiyas, maybe to the Delhi Sultanate, and then the various Deccan Sultanates, before it gets into the Mughal fold, it remains somewhat foggy, right? A blend of historical record and tantalizing legend.
Yeah, it's like a legend that gradually materializes into more concrete, recorded history at a certain pivotal point. You sort of see it coming into focus.
Which brings us to a new era, one of immense imperial splendor and burgeoning power, the Mughal Empire. This dynasty bursts onto the Indian subcontinent scene with Babur's invasion in April 1526. He brought with him not only formidable cavalry, but also advanced military tech, like cannons and muskets, which fundamentally changed warfare in India and allowed him to decisively defeat the Delhi Sultanate.
Babur's personal journey, which he meticulously documented in his memoir, The Baburnama, reveals a man driven by ambition. He had this deep disdain for a homeless and helpless existence, always campaigning, always seeking to establish a lasting dominion. It was in the aftermath of his decisive victory over Ibrahim Lodi, the last Delhi Sultan, at the Battle of Panipat, that his son, Humayun, received an extraordinary diamond as part of the valuable offerings from the defeated ruler's treasury.
And this is likely the Kohinoor.
It's widely believed to be, yes. Though its exact identity from that very nascent period of Mughal rule is still debated by historians, adding to its mystique. Babur himself noted its immense value, saying it was so famous that no one knew its value.
Humayun's reign, though, despite inheriting this incredible jewel, was marked by significant challenges and instability. He faced this period of enforced exile in Persia, lost his military prowess and much of his kingdom for a time. It must have been a period of profound personal hardship for him.
Definitely. But he eventually regained support from the Safavid Shah and returned to India. He brought back not only renewed military strength, but also, crucially, more gems and the sophisticated artistic influences of the Persian court, which really enriched the developing Mughal aesthetic. And during this period, the diamond actually briefly left imperial control. It circulated through various Deccan sultanates before eventually finding its way back into Mughal possession, a testament to its irresistible allure and its portability as a high-value asset.
Now, what's fascinating here is the distinct Mughal aesthetic and their relationship with gems. You mentioned they often preferred colored gemstones.
Yes, like rubies, emeralds, and sapphires over colorless diamonds. This preference was deeply influenced by the Persian culture they admired so much. These colored stones, often cut as cabochons, not faceted, were seen to embody a vibrancy and natural beauty that appealed to their artistic sensibilities.
Interesting. So diamonds weren't the ultimate.
Not necessarily in the same way. However, they profoundly understood the symbolic power inherent in jewels, especially massive ones, or those with historical resonance, like the Kohinoor. As Abul Fazl, Emperor Akbar's chief advisor, put it in the Ain Akbari, kings are fond of external splendor because they consider it an image of the divine glory. Jewels weren't just adornments, they were manifestations of divine right, imperial magnificence, cosmic order. They reflected the very essence of the ruler's power and connection to the divine.
Literal pieces of heaven on earth.
Exactly that. meant to awe and command reverence.
This gemstone obsession really peaked with the later Mughal emperors, didn't it? Particularly Jahangir.
Absolutely. Jahangir significantly expanded the royal collection through conquest, tribute, and active acquisition. He was a true connoisseur of jewels, with a really keen eye for quality and provenance. He even received a massive 348 Rati's diamond, which was considerably larger than the original stone Babur had acquired. His personal passion for gems was something he cultivated and passed directly to his son, Prince Karam,
who would become the legendary Emperor Shah Jahan.
Precisely. Known for his architectural marvels, like the Taj Mahal, and even greater opulence.
And Shah Jahan, I mean, he took this fascination to an entirely new level, almost unimaginable. His profound obsession with gems and his vision for imperial grandeur culminated in the creation of one of the most legendary artifacts in history. The peacock throne, the Takht-e Tavis.
Right, and this wasn't just furniture. It was a movable, glittering testament to Mughal power, designed to be the very center of the universe as seen from the imperial court. It took 7 years to build, thousands of artisans, and cost an astronomical sum, some say roughly four times the cost of the Taj Mahal itself.
Four times the Taj.
An incredible figure.
Oh, the peacock throne. You have to really try and picture it to grasp the sheer majesty. Imagine this. A lavish, gilded octagon, shaped like a European hat, apparently, utterly encrusted with over a ton of gold and literally millions of jewels, rubies, emeralds, sapphires, and of course, diamonds. At its pinnacle sat this magnificent peacock, crafted from emeralds and rubies, with two open wings forming a canopy above the emperor's head. And the Kohinoor diamond, then a flattened pear shape, was attached right to the peacock's head, a gem so magnificent that, as the French jeweler Jean-Baptiste Tavernier observed, its price no one but God himself could know.
Incredible description.
And there were even pearls the size of pigeon's eggs strung on wire, attached to the 12 pillars supporting the throne, creating this shimmering curtain effect. The entire structure was so grand it was designed to be disassembled for transport, needing multiple elephants and a huge entourage to carry its pieces during rail progresses.
It served as the ultimate potent symbol of imperial power and divine right. It merged exquisite beauty with absolute authority, a breathtaking statement of Mughal supremacy over the known world, designed to overwhelm the senses and command absolute submission.
But that splendor, magnificent as it was, also served as a tempting beacon, didn't it? Drawing covetous eyes from beyond the Mughal Empire's borders. And with immense wealth often comes immense vulnerability. This brings us to a turning point, a real cataclysmic event that would redefine the diamond's path and arguably seal the fate of an empire. The 1739 invasion of Delhi by Nader Shah of Persia.
Yeah, this invasion happened at a time when the once formidable Mughal army, despite its size, had become, well, as contemporary accounts put it, little more than an undisciplined rabble. This was really a direct consequence of years of neglect by Emperor Muhammad Shah. He was, by all accounts, more interested in the happy pursuit of pleasure, courtly amusements, pigeon fights, dancing girls, than in military affairs or governance.
Not exactly focused on defense.
Not at all. This profound disarray and decline in military discipline allowed Nader Shah, who was a brilliant and ruthless commander, to just shatter Mughal authority with shocking ease, even though he was numerically disadvantaged. His forces basically marched through a demoralized and ineffective defense.
The invasion culminated in the infamous and brutal looting of Delhi, and of course the Peacock Throne itself. The city was just ransacked for weeks. It was during this period, precisely when it entered Nader Shah's possession, that the diamond gained its now famous name, Kohinoor, meaning Mountain of Light. Legend has it, Nader Shah exclaimed this when he saw it, recognizing its unparalleled brilliance.
A fitting name given its size and sparkle.
Definitely. But it wasn't the only treasure taken. Other major jewels like the Dar-e-Noor, the Sea of Light, which is a spectacular pink diamond, and the Ain al-Hur, the Eye of the Hurry, were also seized, along with just an unfathomable amount of gold, silver, and other valuables. The total loot was estimated to be worth tens of millions of pounds in contemporary value. It effectively emptied the Mughal treasury.
And the human cost of this invasion was just immense. A true tragedy for Delhi's people. There's one particularly desperate and poignant scene recorded. Nizam-ul-Mulk, a revered Mughal noble and former vizier, went bareheaded, his hands tied with his own turban, and begged Nader Shah on his knees to spare Delhi's inhabitants from further massacre. While the killing was eventually stopped after his plea, the systematic robbing, torture, and plundering just continued relentlessly for weeks. The city was stripped bare, its people traumatized, its imperial prestige utterly shattered. This moment really marked the beginning of the end for the great Mughal Empire. It never truly recovered its former glory after that.
But the diamond, it seemed, continued to carry its ominous curse forward, following its new owner. Nader Shah's reign was short-lived and increasingly plagued by paranoia and cruelty. Just 2 years after the Delhi invasion in 1741, he survived an assassination attempt orchestrated by his own nephew. This incident tragically fueled his descent into madness, leading him to blind his own son, Riza Kohli, in a fit of paranoia. He famously cried out, "What is a father? What is a son?"
A chilling descent.
It really is. The diamond's trail of havoc, connecting immense wealth with immense tragedy, just continued its grim pattern.
Yeah, and it raises this important question about the transient and often brutal nature of absolute power, especially when it's acquired through violence. Nader Shah's ultimate end was gruesome. He was murdered by Muhammad Qali Khan and Saleh Khan, two of his own commanders, in his own tent in 1747. This was just 8 years after he had crowned himself Shah of Persia. He perished as the wealthiest monarch on earth, a stark illustration that even with unimaginable riches and military might, rule can be fleeting, brutal, and ultimately self-destructive. The Mountain of Light had indeed brought him immense power, but it seemed to also usher in an era of darkness and paranoia, leading straight to his violent end.
Following Nader Shah's violent end and the fragmentation of his short-lived empire, the Koh-i-Noor continued its tumultuous journey, passing through the hands of his successors. It eventually transferred to Ahmad Shah Durrani, a former general in Nader Shah's army, who went on to found the Durrani dynasty in Afghanistan. His initial conquest certainly helps consolidate his power through foreign wars, enhancing his reputation and providing crucial resources from the loot of India.
Right, he built his power base partly on that wealth.
But his reign was also marred by a severe and debilitating illness, possibly leprosy or maybe a tumor, which physically disfigured him, caused him immense suffering, and incapacitated him in his later years. This personal tragedy, this slow decline, cast a long shadow over his military successes. Once again, some might say, connecting the diamond to misfortune.
And what's particularly fascinating here is the diamond's eventual transition from Afghan to Sikh possession. This marks a significant and, frankly, improbable geographical and political shift for the legendary gem. After passing through several hands within the Durrani dynasty, including Shah Shuja Durrani, who famously wore it while in exile, it eventually made its way to the formidable Ranjit Singh, the founder of the Sikh Empire.
How did that happen? Was it taken in battle?
It was more complex, often through a blend of negotiation, maybe some subtle coercion, and exploiting Shah Shuja's vulnerable position when he sought refuge in Lahore. It really highlighted the diamond's persistent role as a bargaining chip in the power struggles of the subcontinent.
Ranjit Singh is such a complex and compelling character in this story, isn't he? A true self-made monarch. While he was known for being unpretentious, you know, making himself accessible even to the humblest petitioner, and generally respecting non-Sikh beliefs, visiting Muslim Sufi shrines, celebrating Hindu festivals, he also had his excesses.
Oh, definitely.
The French traveler, Victor Jacquemont, described him as a wily, clever, and charming old rogue who indulged in drugs, drink, and dancing girls. He even apparently humorously lamented that women no longer give him any more pleasure than the flowers in his garden.
Ah, quite the character.
This duality, his strategic brilliance combined with his, well, earthy, hedonistic side, makes him a truly fascinating figure in Indian history.
And Ranjit Singh had this deep, almost spiritual, personal passion for the Koh-i-Noor. He didn't just own it, he revered it. He saw it as a symbol of his divine right to rule and the prosperity of his empire. He elevated its status significantly by wearing it on all public occasions, often strapped to his bicep, or adorning his turban, ensuring that its brilliance was inextricably linked to his own imperial image.
He really put it front and center.
Absolutely. And when it wasn't being worn, he implemented this elaborate, almost paranoid security regime for it, hiding it in the impregnable Gobindgarh Fort, one of the most secure places in his kingdom. He even employed this clever deception when he traveled, using two exact glass replicas moved on different camels within his heavily guarded train, designed to confuse potential thieves.
Oh, decoys.
Yeah. His master of the jewel house, Mr. Beliram, was the only other person allowed to handle it and reportedly treated it as if it was a living, dangerous bird of prey. He apparently chained the three caskets, one real, two replicas, to his bed when they camped for the night. This obsession speaks volumes about the diamond's perceived power, not just its monetary value.
And while Ranjit Singh and the British were outwardly friendly, exchanging gifts and diplomatic pleasantries, there was this underlying strategic tension, right?
Very much so. The British, specifically the East India Company, viewed his formidable Sikh army as the last major military force in India that could truly challenge their burgeoning power. By the 1830s, the company had strategically positioned nearly half of its Bengal army, over 39,000 troops, right along the Punjab frontier. This illustrates their underlying strategic concern and readiness for conflict. They were meticulously observing the Sikh kingdom for any signs of weakness.
Ranjit Singh's final days in June 1839 were marked by his imminent death after suffering a third major stroke. Haunted by this, he began giving away his most valuable possessions, vast sums of gold, attempting to accrue spiritual merit in his last moments. He undertook a final pilgrimage to Amritsar, donating huge amounts to religious charities, including cows with gilded horns and elephants with gold howdahs, those ornate seats.
Trying to secure his legacy, perhaps?
Maybe. He then assembled his senior officers to make them swear allegiance to his eldest son, Karak Singh, trying to secure the succession and ensure the stability of the empire he'd built. The future of his beloved Koh-i-Noor also weighed heavily on his mind. Some accounts suggest he wished to donate it to the Jagannath Temple in Puri, though that never actually happened.
His cremation was a truly grand, almost surreal, and profoundly tragic affair. It drew thousands to the Lahore fort. A European doctor, John Martin Honenberger, was there and observed the grotesque spectacle and the intense emotions of the grieving masses. He vividly noted the unwillingness of some queens to partake in the Saudi tradition, the ritual self-immolation on the husband's pyre implying an element of coercion or intense social pressure.
That's horrifying.
It is. And he added the unsettling detail that the remains of 7 slave girls were also mixed in with the powdered gray ashes of the Maharaja, highlighting the harsh realities of social class and patriarchal customs within the ceremony. It was a chaotic and poignant end to the reign of the Lion of Punjab.
Following Ranjit Singh's death, British intelligence reports, like those from Captain C.M. Wade, immediately picked up on the burgeoning unrest and political instability in the region.
Right, the cracks started showing immediately.
And the diamond, amidst all this chaos, was rumored to have been sent to Orissa, as per Ranjit Singh's disputed final wishes. Information the British tracked very closely because they understood the immense symbolic power of the gem.
Absolutely. They recognized that whoever possessed the Koh-i-Noor would hold a powerful claim to the legitimacy of rule in Punjab. It was a key symbol.
The period right after Ranjit Singh's death was indeed one of intense political instability and bloody succession struggles. It's often called the Punjab Anarchy. His eldest son, Karak Singh, alienated nobles with his louche behavior, throwing lavish parties, getting drunk for days, which led to a plot to murder him just 4 months into his reign.
Didn't last long.
No. His subsequent death, possibly by poisoning, was followed by the very suspicious accident of his son, now Nihal Singh. His head was most awfully crushed by falling masonry moments after his father's funeral procession. Eyewitness accounts varied wildly on the circumstances, fueling rumors of foul play.
Sounds incredibly convenient.
Doesn't it? This plunged Lahore into a profound crisis. The succession became entirely unclear. Various factions vied for control, leading to this rapid succession of weak rulers and assassinations.
And in this profound chaos, an anonymous letter surfaced titled A Voice from Kashmir. It was likely from a British agent with intimate insider knowledge of the Sikh court. This letter explicitly urged the East India Company to seize the diamond. This agent believed the Koh-i-Noor was the key to the whole kingdom of Punjab, openly suggesting that the British must either tameably submit to Karak Singh retaining it or commence hostilities against him.
Wow, so they were actively being encouraged to intervene for the diamond.
It certainly seems that way. This demonstrates how closely the British had been eyeing the gem and the Sikh kingdom, viewing the diamond not just as a prize, but as this potent symbol of control and legitimacy. Its acquisition would signify ultimate dominance.
The British didn't waste much time making their move amidst this profound turbulence, did they? They seized their opportunity. Following the devastating Anglo-Sikh wars, which were fiercely fought but ultimately saw the superior British military prevail, and a subsequent rebellion led by Morash, whom the British conveniently painted as a bloodthirsty despot trying to overthrow the young Maharaja Duleep Singh and his British allies. Well, Punjab was formally annexed in 1849.
The end of Sikh independence.
Exactly. And the loss of the Koh-i-Noor wasn't just the seizure of a jewel. It powerfully symbolized the complete subjugation of the once mighty Sikh empire. it marked the final major independent kingdom in India falling under British rule.
And then came the treaty. In a deeply significant and historically controversial moment, the Treaty of Lahore was signed in 1849. This document compelled the then 10-year-old Maharaja Daleep Singh, who was effectively a prisoner under British guardianship, to surrender not just great swaths of the richest land in India, the independent kingdom of Punjab, but also, critically, the Kohinoor diamond.
A 10-year-old signed it away.
Effectively, yes, under duress and guidance. Article 3 of the document stated with chilling clarity, "The gem called the Kohinoor, which was taken by Maharaja Ranjit Singh from Shah Shuja-ul-Mulk, shall be surrendered by the Maharaja of Lahore to the Queen of England." That wording is crucial. It attempts to establish this historical lineage of acquisition, effectively legitimizing the British claim through previous act of conquest, framing it as just another transfer.
Lord Dalhousie, the Governor General of India at the time, was absolutely triumphant about this acquisition. He saw it as the culmination of British imperial ambition in India. He declared with immense satisfaction, "I had now caught my hare," viewing the diamond as the ultimate prize from the conquest.
Such a telling phrase.
Isn't it? He later added that the diamond, having been a historical emblem of conquest in India for centuries, had now found its proper resting place within the British Empire. This phrase just perfectly encapsulates the imperial mindset of the time. This belief that objects of power from conquered lands naturally belonged in the hands of the conquering empire, seen not as theft, but as a natural progression, a sort of civilizing mission that justified appropriation, a stark assertion of British supremacy.
The diamond's passage to England was orchestrated under incredibly tight security, a true testament to its perceived value and importance. John Loggan, Duleep Singh's new guardian, was initially quite impressed by the young Maharaja. He described him as a very fine-tempered boy, intelligent and handsome. Loggan actually held this deeply idealistic, perhaps naive hope. He believed Queen Victoria might choose to pay for the diamond if she wanted it, and that the money could then be used to benefit the people of Punjab, making the Punjab to bloom like a garden and converting the possession of the Kohinoor into a blessing instead of a curse.
A nice thought, but...
Exactly. His hopes did not materialize. No payment was ever made for the diamond. It was taken as an explicit term of the peace treaty, an act of war settlement.
The diamond was transported aboard HMS Medea under really stringent security measures, sailing from Bombay and finally arriving in Britain on June 30, 1850. Its arrival was eagerly anticipated, sparking widespread media speculation and public excitement. A true imperial spectacle was expected.
But its formal presentation to Queen Victoria on July 3, 1850, was surprisingly overshadowed by personal tragedy. Victoria was apparently quite distracted by the sudden and unexpected death of her confidant and former prime minister, Sir Robert Peel. He died just a day earlier from a fall off his horse. Media speculation about the diamond's supposed dark powers immediately intensified, linking it to Peel's death and even to a cane attack Victoria had endured just 2 days prior, which left her with a prominent cut on her forehead and a scar for years.
So the curse narrative jumped continents.
Pretty much instantly. These seemingly coincidental misfortunes just fueled the tales of the gem's curse, a narrative that had now firmly entered the European popular imagination, often conveniently applied to justify or just sensationalize its bloody history.
Despite these rather somber circumstances, the Kohinoor was promptly lent to the Great Exhibition of 1851 in London, heralded by Prince Albert as the greatest show on earth. This grand spectacle, housed in the magnificent Crystal Palace, was designed to showcase British industrial and cultural achievements to the world, a triumphant display of imperial might and technological prowess.
And the diamond quickly became the single most famous object of loot from India. It symbolized Victorian Britain's imperial domination of the world more than perhaps any other object there. It was displayed in this high-security glass safe within a metal cage. The display was even reconfigured with pink cloth, gas jets, and mirrors, apparently designed to make it tantalizingly difficult to see, adding to its mystique and controlling the public's access to this powerful symbol.
Playing hard to get, even in a cage.
You could say that. Newspapers enthusiastically embraced this, stating the display itself was a metaphor for British supremacy. Golden hands clasping it represented the Queen's delicate hold, while the massive and impenetrable safe illustrated British power to defy enemies and secure its treasures. It truly embodied the aspirations of a nation eager to display its wealth, influence, and the spoils of its rapidly expanding empire.
Then came a crucial and highly controversial decision in 1852, driven by Prince Albert. He was convinced that the diamond in its traditional mogul cut lacked sufficient brilliance compared to contemporary European cuts, so he ordered it to be recut to enhance its sparkle.
Right, the famous recutting.
This process, performed by the royal jeweler Gerard of London and overseen by the Dutch diamantair Moses Koster, drastically reduced its size. It went from its weight upon arrival in Britain, 190.3 metric carats, down to its current 105.6 carats.
That's a huge loss of historical weight and form.
Absolutely. It altered its historical form, sparking controversy then and now. And sadly, it led to most other great mogul diamonds like the Daria-in Or, subsequently fading from popular memory. The recutting was seen by many as a Europeanization of the stone, an attempt to impose Western aesthetic standards on an ancient Eastern treasure, further solidifying its new identity as a British imperial possession.
From that point forward, the Koh-i-Noor was prominently incorporated into various British royal crowns, symbolizing sovereignty and imperial might. It was first set into the state crown of Queen Victoria, which she wore to open Parliament. Later, it adorned the crown of Queen Alexandra in 1902, Queen Mary in 1911, and ultimately the crown of Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, in 1937, where it remained until recently and is now in Queen Camilla's crown.
So it became a fixture in the consort crowns.
Primarily, yes, associated with the queen consorts after Victoria. Queen Victoria herself publicly wore the diamond to underscore her authority. For instance, during a significant state visit to France in 1855, she wore it prominently at an extravagant ball, captivating the audience and making a clear statement of her power and the reach of her empire. Even after the profound grief of Prince Albert's death in 1861, which caused her to retreat from much public life, Victoria continued to wear the Koh-i-Noor. It was apparently the single piece of jewelry that still conveyed her royal authority despite her deep mourning and public retreat, a constant reminder of her imperial domain.
Shifting our focus now, let's talk about Maharaja Dilip Singh's life in England after the diamond's transfer. This young, deposed ruler quickly became Queen Victoria's favorite, didn't he? She described him as extremely handsome, speaking English perfectly, and possessing a pretty graceful and dignified manner. Victoria was genuinely captivated by him, showering him with gifts like jewelry and cameos of herself. They even spent hours sketching each other at Buckingham Palace and Osborne House, her Isle of Wight retreat.
Yeah, she genuinely seemed to feel a great deal for these poor, deposed Indian princes, as she called them. Seeing them almost as wards, maybe innocent of the larger colonial machinations that had dispossessed them. A complex relationship, for sure. However, Dilip Singh's mother, Rani Jindan, played a truly critical role in awakening his sense of identity and subtly challenging British control. After her release from imprisonment in Nepal, she reunited with Dilip in England in 1861, despite apparently loathing the country that had confined her. She fiercely railed at her son for converting to Christianity, believing he had let the British take not just his kingdom and the Koh-i-Noor, but also his religion and heritage. She successfully sowed seeds of doubt in his mind about the British actions, constantly reminding him of his royal lineage and the injustice of his dispossession.
Her influence was key then.
Absolutely. Her presence on British soil, though initially seen by the British as a way to keep her under watch, ultimately spurred Dilip to question his situation and embark on that path to reclaim his heritage. She died in London in 1863, only 46, looking much older due to her hardships and long imprisonment.
Dilip Singh's life was just profoundly shaped by this shifting political landscape and his evolving identity, wasn't he? Torn between two worlds. His conversion to Christianity was seen as both a strategic political act by the British, stripping him of his Sikh leadership potential, integrating him into British society, and a deeply personal transformation away from his royal heritage. He even rejected Queen Victoria's suggestion of marrying a fellow deposed Indian royal, choosing instead Bamba Miller, described as the illegitimate daughter of a German merchant and an Abyssinian slave, who apparently spoke no English.
Right. This choice, while seemingly personal, perhaps hinted at his growing independence from British expectations and a desire to forge his own path, albeit one often fraught with internal conflict and ultimately tragedy. Dilip increasingly faced severe financial struggles. These were exacerbated by his lavish lifestyle in England, trying to live like the English aristocracy, and his desperate, consuming desire to reclaim his lost heritage. In the early 1880s, the British government offered him this one-off, interest-free loan of £57,000 to pay his soaring debts. But it came with this harsh, almost predatory condition. His estate, Eldon Hall, a vast property he'd acquired, would be sold upon his death, leaving his children without inheritance.
That's brutal.
He was devastated. He believed he'd be unable to provide for his family, who would become homeless and at the mercy of the same state he now believed had robbed him. Driven by his obsession to regain his heritage and break free from this financial trap, he desperately attempted to return to India in 1886 to rally support. But he was arrested by British authorities at Port Said in Egypt before his ship could even reach the Suez Canal. A final, humiliating defeat for the last Maharaja.
And tragically, Dilip Singh died penniless and alone in a shabby Parisian hotel in October 1893. Just 53 years old, his dreams of restoration completely unfulfilled. Since none of his children would ever have heirs of their own, his very name and the direct line of the Sikh Empire died with him. It is a profound tragedy still keenly felt in Punjab today. It represents the complete loss of a royal lineage under colonial rule and a poignant end to the story of a king without a kingdom, perpetually haunted by the loss of his heritage and, of course, his most famous diamond.
Which brings us right up to the modern controversy surrounding the diamond's ownership and the persistent calls for its repatriation. Claims for the Kohinoor have come from various nations, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, even the Taliban made a claim in 2001, each citing historical links and the circumstances of its transfer. The diamond, despite its physical transformation and its current setting in the Queen Mother's crown, now Camilla's, remains at the center of ongoing international dissent and a really powerful symbol of colonial legacy.
There was that particularly controversial moment in April 2016, wasn't there? When India's Solicitor General Ranjit Kumar told the Indian Supreme Court that the Kohinoor was neither stolen nor forcibly taken, but had been gifted to the British.
Yes, that caused quite a stir.
I mean, considering Ranjit Singh, the last independent Sikh ruler, had been dead for a decade in 1849 when the treaty was signed, and his 10-year-old son was compelled to surrender it. Well, the statement caused a deluge of mockery for its clear historical inaccuracy.
It really did. It sparked immediate public outrage in India and highlighted the complexities and sensitivities of the debate, even within the claimant nations themselves. It showed a clear disconnect between public sentiment and perhaps governmental positions at times. And the broader debates over restitution really underscore the ongoing legacy of British imperialism and its impact on cultural heritage. Historians and politicians like Shashi Tharoor have made compelling arguments for symbolic reparations. Tharoor, while dismissing the feasibility of full financial compensation for the vast wealth extracted from India over centuries, has suggested that Britain could, for example, pay India £1 per annum for 200 years.
Just £1 a year.
Exactly. He argues it wouldn't be about demanding full financial restitution, but rather a powerful symbolic gesture. A way to acknowledge the historical injustices and begin to repair historical fractures, acknowledging the moral debt without crippling the present.
And this connects to even broader discussions on colonial reparations and international law, which seem to be gaining increasing traction globally, right?
Very much so.
International law, as Tharoor points out, states that an obligation to provide reparations arises when a violation of international law takes place, and it continues till a substantial step is taken to atone for the violation. We've seen other significant restitution cases lately, the return of the Benin bronzes by various European museums to Nigeria, the ongoing demands for the mechanical figure of Tipu's tiger, even the demand for the repatriation of the body of a Rwandan king.
Right. These aren't isolated incidents. They're part of a global movement for historical justice, where nations are increasingly confronting the difficult legacies of their colonial pasts and the provenance of their museum collections. And what's profoundly significant here is the argument from that report, the report on the restitution of African cultural heritage by Felwine Sarr and Benedict Savoy, which was commissioned by the French government. They passionately argue that returning cultural objects helps erase some of the wounds inflicted by colonialism and is crucial for reconstructing the identity of communities that were systematically stripped of their heritage.
It's about more than just the object itself.
Exactly. It's about acknowledging history, healing collective memory, and allowing formerly colonized nations to reclaim not just their artifacts, but their narratives and their sense of self in the modern world. The Kohinoor is just one glittering, very famous facet of this much larger ongoing dialogue.
So what does this all mean for us today as we reflect on this remarkable and often brutal journey? The tumultuous story of the Kohinoor diamond reveals it to be far, far more than just a magnificent jewel. It is a potent, glittering symbol of conquest, shifting identities, and unresolved history. Within its meticulously cut facets, it carries the dramatic stories of empires rising and falling, of immense wealth and profound loss, and the enduring human drama of power and vulnerability. It's a living artifact, isn't it? The silent witness to a complex, often brutal past, constantly asking us to confront its legacy.
Which really raises an important question for you, the listener, to consider as you reflect on the Kohinoor's extraordinary saga. Can a jewel ever truly be owned in a definitive and unquestionable sense, especially when its history is so deeply interwoven with conquest and shifting power? Or does it, in essence, belong more to the cultures and peoples it has traversed through, perpetually carrying their history, their triumphs, and yes, their wounds within its very brilliance? It really forces us to rethink what ownership truly means in the context of contested heritage and the long, long shadow of empire.